rock the mic. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday. It is the 31st of July, the last day of July, and it's 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. A pleasure to have you all with us. And I welcome you where you have a lot to discuss. We have some really important things to discuss, and we will do so in just a moment. A reminder that you can always join in on the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. All right, let us get to the invitations here and invite everyone in. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm well. Estoy aquí. Je suis ici. Si.
Si. Si.
I'm here. I'm raring to go.
Yes. Well, good. Excellent. We'll start with that. Senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator Judith Enck. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
Good morning. July has been a very long year.
It has. It has. I remember at the beginning of July, there was a cartoon that did the rounds. It may have been a New Yorker cartoon, where it had the people that were labeled June, and the door was labeled July, and they were just pushing it very ever so slightly,
yes.
Looking in to
yes.
say, "Oh my God, well." We could just use the same cartoon for August, right? I don't think there's any difference.
Yes.
And maybe for the rest of our lives. Who knows? But it's good to have you here, Judith. Thank you. UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, is with us. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Good morning, everyone.
Wonderful to have you with us. I am very, very happy to introduce our next guest. Ira Fussfeld is with us. Ira has not been on our program for a very, very long time. We have missed him horribly. And it's up to Ira whether he wants to tell you of why he has not been on the program. But the important fact is that he's back, and life is better when you have Ira with you. Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Joe, nice to talk to you. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Happy to be with you.
So,
and the answer to your previous question, it's I don't want to bog the listeners down with it, with my issues, but in short, I've been suffering or trying to recover from Bell's palsy, for those people who have heard of that, and it's been about 5 months, and I'm not all the way back yet, but I'm told that my voice is listenable, so we'll find out. The listeners can give me some feedback if I'm making a mess of it.
But Ira,
give it a shot.
Ira, did you ever find out who Bell was? You know, these.
I'm thinking it was Buddy Bell. He was the infielder for the Reds.
It was all his fault. You know, my brother had this years and years and years ago, and when he was in the Marine Corps, and when he got out, of course, he's fine, but he still finds that he can't blow up balloons. So I don't know if you had that in your future
or not. Well, that was not a problem, but I'm more interested in being able to get my mouth open to get a hamburger in it, and it's still a struggle, but it's coming along, and that, you know, when I first got this in the beginning of March, we were all looking over our shoulders to see if COVID was coming, and fortunately, that's not what I got. But I didn't bargain for this to happen.
Have you lost weight, Ira, as a result of this?
No. Actually, I pretty much maintained, which is the good news and the bad news. But you know, losing weight from this would not really be an issue. Sitting home for it so long has been an issue, however.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, it's a thrill to hear your voice, and I'm very glad you're with us, and thank you very much.
Thank you, and let me know if I'm not making any sense sound-wise.
Oh, we'll let you know. Don't you worry.
Okay. I know I'm not going to make any sense point-wise.
Well, it's hard to make sense of what's going on. Final, and I've been kind of vamping a little bit because we're trying to get everybody on the line, but Aaron Pacitti is with us. He is the Siena College economics professor, and Aaron joins us. Aaron has it in his rider that he can't join us for the full show. He's just here to talk about the economy, going to just bum us out, and then he's going to leave. Right, Aaron? Is that the deal?
Yeah, that's exactly what my agent arranged with your people. So,
you know, Ira, it's going to be like one of those Bob Hope walk-ons on Carson. You come in, you talk about the special, and then you get the hell out. That's it.
Oh, that's good. I like to be Foster Brooks today.
All right.
There's going to be a very heavy mic drop around 10 a.m.
All right.
And you wouldn't believe what Aaron requires in the green room.
No, I know.
Evian water and organic green tea. He's so
demanding. Yeah, a bowl of M&Ms that have all of the brown and yellow ones taken out.
That's right. Yes. And Judith has been lovely in helping me do that. So you're welcome.
We've been at this since 6 a.m. for Aaron's arrival.
So Aaron's with us for a short time, but so we'll get to that story first. Good morning, everyone. It's lovely to have you all here, and I thank you very much. It's nice checking in with all of our family and finding out how things are. We obviously want to keep everyone close as we live through this pandemic in this very, very weird time. Let us begin with the economic collapse that is happening, a collapse that wiped out 5 years of growth with no bounce in sight. If you look at this on a graph, you can't imagine it being much worse. The second quarter contraction set a grim record, and it would have been worse without government aid. But guess what? That government aid is expiring. And so what does that mean for the third quarter? And that is why we have Aaron with us this morning. Let's begin with him, and we'll talk about this. The coronavirus pandemic's toll on the nation's economy became emphatically clearer Thursday as the government detailed the most devastating three-month collapse on record, which wiped out that 5 years of growth. Gross national product, the broadest measure of goods and services produced, fell 9.5% in the second quarter of the year as consumers cut back spending, businesses pared investments, and global trade dried up. That according to the Commerce Department. How bad is it, Aaron?
Oh, it's bad. This is unprecedented, but it's also not a surprise. Economists have been forecasting an absolutely catastrophic decrease in GDP really beginning in April. So this really didn't come as a surprise. It's just one of those things where even though it wasn't a surprise to actually see the release and to process it and to know that it's real as opposed to just the possibility is legitimately frightening. So it's some things to keep in mind is that the U.S. economy entered a recession beginning in February. So even before the pandemic started in full force in March, the National Bureau of Economic Research dated the recession as beginning in February. So what has happened now with the pandemic is that it has really highlighted the fragility of the U.S. economy and a lot of the structural causes or a lot of the structural parts of the economy that really have been neglected for the past 40 years. Things like rising inequality, stagnant wage growth, limited economic mobility. None of those are new, and those have been happening for decades. So all it took was somebody to throw a match on that kindling. It really could have been anything, but it just happens to be the pandemic. So now we're seeing the full effects of this, is that it's an economy that is not prepared economically to handle this. We are not prepared politically to handle this, and it's downright frightening. So there's two things that happened yesterday that are cause for alarm, and I'll start with the short one, and that's the second consecutive week of an increase in unemployment insurance claims. So we've been historically, unemployment insurance claims average about 200,000 per week. And now the average is, or the low during this period is around like 1.4 million. So it's about seven times the normal number of people applying for unemployment insurance benefits. And that's starting to tick up after a couple months of decline. This is scary because the federal pandemic unemployment insurance compensation subsidy, the $600 bonus that workers got, expires today. So as of now, workers who get unemployment insurance checks beginning in August are going to find them to be $600 less. And that is going to, if it's not fixed by policy, and it doesn't seem like there's a lot of political will to do that, create an absolute black hole and drive consumption and business investment down further. So the big report was the GDP report, that it fell almost 10% in the second quarter. a lot of people are focusing on this 33% number, which is the annualized rate. So if the economy grew or contracted as much as it did in the second quarter and continues for over a year, that would result in a contraction of about a third. That's probably not going to happen. The stimulus measures helped. Hopefully there'll be a second round, which will help even if it's really small and inadequate. But the bounce back that economists are predicting in quarter three is not even going to be close to making up for the catastrophic drop in quarter two. So just to give you an idea of the scale of this collapse, at the peak of the Great Depression in 1932, the economy contracted 13% in 1 year. And during the World War II demobilization in 1946, GDP contracted 12%. So we are literally in a historic moment where the contraction in the economy is going to rival that of the darkest period in American economic history, which is the Great Depression, and then the war demobilization. Now, it's entirely possible that this trend of increased contraction and rising unemployment can continue indefinitely into the future if two conditions are met. And the first one is that politicians and the public don't take the public health issue seriously. Financial markets and economists, and Jerome Powell said this, the chairman of the Fed said this in his speech after the Fed meetings this week, that it's going to be the virus that determines the trajectory of the economy. That means how quickly a vaccine's developed. That means how people's behavior changes. Politicians in the Fed are not in the driver's seat anymore, and that's really the first time in economic history we have experienced something like this. So that's frightening. The second issue is that if the fiscal stimulus coming out in the next, hopefully, couple days, but probably more realistically the next couple weeks, if that is not sufficient, you're going to see massive declines in household income, a rise of corporate bankruptcies, a collapse in consumption and investment, and all of that is just going to feed upon itself and start affecting other industries. And we've already seen Boeing and Harley Davidson and Microsoft and all these other major corporations enact layoffs. So there is no guarantee that there's going to be a sharp bounce back in the third quarter, let alone the fourth quarter. So even if there's a bounce back, I've been saying this, for as long as this happened, is that we're probably going to be bouncing along the bottom for a while, but the bigger risk isn't so much the pandemic induced contraction. It's going to be now that this contraction has been cemented and people's behavior has changed, households and businesses face legitimate and anxiety-inducing uncertainty. When people face uncertainty, they freeze up. They don't make big purchases. Households don't go out and buy new cars or new washing machines. They might have to opt to, forgo sending their kids to college. Businesses aren't going to be hiring. And that uncertainty is going to lead to probably a lost decade of economic activity.
A decade.
A lost decade. The Congressional Budget Office, which is as nonpartisan as they get, estimates that it's not going to be until 2029 that the U.S. economy returns to pre-pandemic levels of employment and growth.
Now, let me ask you a question, because yesterday I was watching, I listened to the funeral of John Lewis, and then when I got home, I watched President Obama speak, and after that, I was just a puddle. And so I started to watch, I started to bet the horses at Saratoga in my living room. And then I went over to see the president. Well, he says everything's going to be good in the third quarter. So where are you getting your numbers?
Yeah, I mean, there will be a bounce back in the third quarter. I'm getting them from somewhere other than Donald Trump's head. There will be a bounce back. just because the economy has contracted so much, that the gradual reopening of the economy that began in May and June and July is going to show up in the third quarter numbers. So there will be a bounce back. It's just not going to be enough of a bounce back to make up for the decline that happened in the second quarter.
All right.
And again, that's a political issue, and that's also a behavioral and public health issue.
So let me ask you a question.
We have a minute, but go ahead.
Okay, very quickly, Aaron. There's a negotiation going on between the House and the Senate. Trump knows he's got to do something because people have to have some food on the table. He says, let's continue the $600 and nothing else. Will that make a difference?
Yeah, that will. You know, the $1,200 stimulus checks were nice, and it certainly propped up household incomes, but it's not enough to get us through the long haul. I think you're going to need to see radical measures of household income support, starting with the $600, and I think it needs to go beyond that.
And the Democrats, that,
if you want,
Democrats
won't break.
Right, the Democrats won't agree to that. They want a lot more than just $600.
All right, so let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue, and we will talk more and bring in the whole panel and talk about this and other issues. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and, of course, Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Ira Fussfeld, Jennifer Burns, and Aaron Pasitti. We'll be right back. Playing the music of Malik B this morning, a founding member of The Roots who died on Wednesday. He was 47 years old. We have our playlist online, as always, WAMC.org/roundtable. All right. Anyone have any questions for Aaron on what we heard before the break? If you're well enough to be able to form sentences.
I have a question, Aaron, if I may. GDP. Versus stock market? That's my question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yes. This is kind of the a seeming contradiction in that you have the biggest contraction in GDP. You have 11% unemployment. It seems like there's no floor or safety net, to prevent this from falling further, and yet the stock market, climbs up. It's got some volatile days. The important thing, like I started this off with, is that everybody expected this dramatic fall, and it was more or less in line with expectations. So the stock market prices in future expectations. So that the big decline that happened in March and April was the response to, oh, this is going to be bad for a while. And then as news filtered in that maybe things aren't as bad as it appears, you saw the increase in the stock market. So the stock market's always looking ahead. But the stock market's volatile. There are as many up days as there are down days during periods of economic volatility. So I think what's the one thing the stock market can't forecast effectively is the political response. So just because it's been high, despite, really catastrophic economic news, if there's not a sufficient second round of stimulus, if people's, independent of shutdowns, if people's behavior has changed in that they're not going out and consuming, it's entirely possible that the stock market might enter a prolonged bear market.
Yeah, meaning that for those who may not know, because we have a lot of bears around here, real bears.
Real bears, yeah.
That means
a decrease in stock prices.
Right. And then the second question is China, question mark?
China, question mark?
Yeah. It seems to me every time China gets into a prolonged mess with the United States, the stock market doesn't like it. China seems to be one of those indices that becomes very important. And I wonder, and they keep not announcing that, well, their GDP isn't going up as much as it was. It is going up.
Yeah, I mean, there is the very realistic possibility, and I can't, comment on the validity of this, that in order to preserve social stability, China might present somewhat misleading statistics about the health of their economy. But in the same breath, China has also taken a very heavy-handed approach in terms of state involvement in the economy in terms of funding infrastructure projects and stimulus programs that their decrease in GDP might not be as dramatic as it has been in the U.S. because there was a very quick and coordinated response that certainly did not happen in the U.S. or as we saw this morning with the decrease in GDP in the European Union. So, China's kind of a wild card. They're a major U.S. trading partner. That's where you get a lot of our low-cost, imports, which helps offset some of the negative effects of unemployment and stagnant wages. What's happening in China is kind of a different beast than what's happening in the U.S.
Judith.
Well, I think so much of this would have been avoided if only President Trump and his minions had taken the science seriously, just like we're going over the cliff with climate change because they don't respect science. They never grasped, and they still do not grasp, the reality that the best economic policy is effectively addressing the spread of the virus. I long maintained that they decided not to do a national plan and a national approach, which is clearly needed, because this was only going to affect states they don't care about politically, like California,
Washington.
Narrative. Oh, can you hear me now?
Yep, go ahead. Yep.
Is that better?
Yep.
And then there was the narrative that, oh, only old people are going to die. Like, that was quite inhumane and not accurate. So we're still going to circle the drain economically until there is an effective national health approach, which even today the president is resisting. So the only way for the economy to rebound is to have a good strategy on combating the virus, and the only way that's going to happen is if you get Trump out of the White House.
Ira.
Well, I'm listening to Aaron's grim assessment, and I have no doubt that he's accurate. And I'm just trying to sit here thinking about what this country is going to look like if we do have another quarter or more, or, you know, God forbid, going into the end of this decade in this kind of financial distress. I mean, is it just going to be millions more people in those cars lining up for food banks? Is more stores are going to close? What will life in the U.S. be if it continues in this direction? And how long would it take us to get to that point?
That's an excellent question, Ira, and I think that's something that's on a lot of people's mind. It's important for economists as a tribe, and for me in particular, not to ignore the very real and prolonged suffering that a lot of households are going to face. It's very easy to get lost in, talking about statistics and, whether this continues for a quarter or two. We're already seeing, incredible hardships that have just, they've been there for the past 40 years. Now they've just been laid bare. It's important to keep that in mind when I say what I'm about to say, and that is this presents kind of a once-in-a-century opportunity to rethink not only what our economy should look like, but also what our country should look like. I mean, we are literally on the cliff of the Second Great Depression. Trump's response to this is arguably worse than Herbert Hoover's response, which was Hoover at least did nothing. He didn't actively make it worse. Trump is actively making it worse. That's frightening. But, there is, thank God, an election in November, hopefully. And since we're on the verge of Great Depression number two, this calls for New Deal number two. And I think it's time that politicians start thinking about things like a permanent guaranteed employment program that essentially replaces the social safety net with job retraining and guaranteed employment, much very similar to what happened during the New Deal. Strategic investment in infrastructure, clean energy, healthcare, education, and you can just keep on adding to that list. Household income support, business support, state and local government support. So the good news is that all of these structural weaknesses that have existed in the economy for decades are now laid very, very bare. And because they're laid bare and haven't been just hidden under the surface, this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to fix the economy and perhaps get the pendulum swinging in the different direction. But between now and then, even if that happens, the poverty, the anxiety, the stress, the in all likelihood, the rise in substance abuse and preventable mortalities that aren't due to the pandemic are going to get worse. For how long, I don't know. But when the American Enterprise Institute starts criticizing President Trump's economic policies, you know something's wrong.
Yeah. Jennifer.
Yeah, I think one of the other key things here is to keep in mind that within everything we're talking about decades of racial disparities as well, right? So the racial disparity for communities of color since the first New Deal, which we know disproportionately didn't help African Americans or people of color, has led us a little bit to where we are now with the disparity we have. So we add in the disparities we know about healthcare and the impact of COVID on Black and brown communities. Yeah. And so if we're looking at this, this economic concern for poor communities and overwhelmingly poor African American or Black and brown communities, right, this is going to extenuate, that economic and racial disparity even more if we do not firmly address and incorporate some kind of racial equity into this rebounding plan. And so I guess my question for Aaron, since he's here, is really how does Joe Biden's economic platform maybe address some of this, or could it?
Great question.
That is a good. Yeah, thank you for bringing up the racial disparities in all of this, because again, this does not affect all groups equally. It is clear, again, this has laid bare some of the disproportionate impacts it's had on Black communities and Latino communities. Biden's economic plan is a start. Fortunately, he has pulled in some reasonably progressive economists that think in terms of guaranteed employment, long-term investment in infrastructure, and policy can be designed to benefit certain groups over others. And for the past 40 years, policy was designed to benefit wealthy groups over all other groups. I think his plan is a step in the right direction. It's not even close to being sufficient to deal with the size of the hole we're in now. And
Aaron, wouldn't you agree that the Biden economic plan really needs to be directed by medical doctors? Because if you don't have the virus under control, no amount of economic planning is going to be recognized. Doctors have to drive this.
Sure. To a certain extent, yes, absolutely. In the interim, policy can work to essentially fill the void left by unemployment. In that, it can keep households and businesses afloat and prevent it can prevent avoidable bankruptcies, both on the household and the corporate side. So that's important in setting the stage. But yes, like you said, Judith, is that all of this is going to be dictated by the trajectory of the virus. And in order to do that, you need the buy-in and a large-scale program of improving public health.
Let's take a break and pause there. When we come back, we'll finish up with Aaron, and because we're on the clock, the meter's running, we have to go with him. So we'll do that. We'll come back. We'll take some listener letters, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
fascinate as I assassinate a show task. Characters and egos get crushed in trust, and my words stampede like hers in the dust. Cream of all crops, topics I drop with trotter. When heated up, I get hotter because I'm proper. You never knew the lever to the clever few.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we are talking about the economy. Aaron Pasitti, who is an economist, a professor at professor of economics at Siena College, joins us. And we're going to get as much in before he has to leave in just about 10 minutes or so. So a lot of letters. Dan says, how safe are FDIC banks in the worst case scenario?
You know, that's a legacy of the New Deal, and they're pretty safe. You know, the government has an infinite lifespan, and the Federal Reserve has an infinitely large balance sheet. Those can be marshaled to, you know, prevent the bank failures and bank runs that made the Great Depression substantially worse. So, you know, if FDIC insurance gets called into question, we have more important problems to think about, like where we're going to get food from. So I have faith in those institutions to preserve that safety.
Well, that sounds like good news. I think that was only a little bit of good news we've had. I'll take that. Let's see. We go to Molly, who says, doom and gloom. Putin has won, and what's worse, he didn't have to spend more to achieve his goal. Once he got his man Trump into the White House, he could just sit back and observe. Our country is in economic turmoil. We are more divided than ever. Our standing in the world has taken a nosedive, and we have lost faith in our government. Can we come back from this? Asks Molly. Anyone?
I think my guess is probably good as anybody's guess. I think the answer is yes, provided we think hard about what Judith pointed out, which is putting public health first and foremost, and that will increase people's household and business confidence, and with the appropriate type of you know, fiscal policy and government spending, we do have an opportunity to create a new economy, a new political regime that could serve us well going into the future. But yes, Putin definitely accomplished his short-term goal in terms of dividing and polarizing the electorate.
Alan, you were going to say?
No, I think that this Putin question is one which we have largely ignored way too much. And we're really going to have to do that. And if Biden is elected and the Senate goes to the Democrats, if there's a big ifs, and the House continues the way it is, then I think there's going to have to be some very serious reckoning as to what was really going on here and whether Putin bears responsibility that should be reacted to. The other question I had for Aaron is, Aaron, is there any thinking about, because it's the one thing I think that the Republicans really do need to worry about, and that's the potential for any kind of revolution in this country. I mean, it's not something we talk about a lot, but it certainly is something that has happened before to emerging democracies or other things. And I'm wondering whether that word comes into your vocabulary at all.
Yes. It certainly has. I think the revolution won't be, we have seen riots in the streets, literally. And I think that could serve as a catalyst. But in my mind, if you're talking about what used to be a $20 trillion economy that's now a $17.5 trillion economy, you know, instituting revolutionary change is going to be more of a long-term endeavor. Now, if things get worse before they get better, as Ira was alluding to, then I think there is a non-trivial possibility that we see some revolutionary tendencies. And if I can dork out and get academic for a little bit, John Maynard Keynes, who was the
thought
father
that's what you were doing already, but go ahead.
No, not at all.
Okay. Well, there's more? Jesus. Okay.
Yeah, you know, the whole argument that the government should step in and spend massive amounts of money when an economy is depressed or in a recession is actually a very conservative idea. And the thinking behind that is, have the government spend to prevent poverty, starvation, and foreclosures, and use that to preserve the current capitalist system and political establishment precisely to avoid a revolution. That was the logic during the New Deal. That's been the logic for a lot of stimulus packages since then, because if you look at Europe in the 1930s, they went a very different route than the U.S. went, and we all know where that led. So, you know, the concept that government should spend money to, you know, maintain social and economic stability is actually inherently conservative. It's not saying it's designed to prevent a revolution and a shift to, you know, more state involvement, and dare you say socialism rising up in the United States.
I want to add that Go ahead, Ira.
I was just going to say to Alan, don't you agree, or do you agree, that the wild card here, in terms of using that word revolution, is the media? And I mean the media in the sense of social media and the far right media, and the what we know from research, and we know anecdotally that there are people who watch Fox News and who read social media, far-right social media sites, who don't read or are aware of anything else. That is their entire frame of reference. And the social media is such as a new development, certainly compared to the Depression era and beyond, obviously, that the ability of social media and Fox News types to sway the opinion of those who want to be swayed is so significant that unless they sort of get within themselves and pull back and see what's going on in this country, what you suggest is more likely than any of us would like to think.
Well, the Wall Street Journal this morning came out with a blast at Trump. And they are not alone. So I have a feeling that the point that was just made by Aaron about the conservatives worrying about revolution is very good, and very important. I raised it not because I believe in it, but because I think if somebody doesn't have food on their table, there is no accounting for what they're going to do if you take the little bit they have away, which is why Donald Trump right now is saying, okay, I agree we should continue with the $600 and nothing else, because it is the minimum he thinks he can get away with without, you know, chaos in the streets, I suspect.
Well, it's not just food on the table. It's the massive amount of guns that circulate in our society. And as Ira referenced, it's not just Fox News. It's pretty intense right-wing social media that will direct a lot of this. I mean, I used to think if Trump lost Fox News, the country would start turning in a better direction, but I think it's beyond Fox News now. I think Aaron laid out a really interesting, accurate, chilling economic forecast. But I want to suggest that it doesn't have to be that dire. There are a lot of epidemiologists now saying even before we get access to a vaccine, there are concrete things we can do to get out of this nosedive. We can do a national lockdown. Everyone stay in for the next 6 weeks. We can have better testing and faster turnaround. We can have contact tracing, which is not functioning in most states. If we can get the virus under control, we can avoid even worse economic decline and revolution. It means we need national leadership. If Trump would just let Dr. Fauci develop and implement a national plan, we can get out of this even without a vaccine.
Dr. Fauci is, we should note, is testifying right now before the House, so on Capitol Hill. So I'm sure there'll be more coming out about that.
Joe, I was very interested in what Judith just said. A lot of people say if Trump would just, those are her words, just, but he's not doing it. And so that leaves us with the reality of the situation. And that is, what do we do with the president of the United States who is playing in Putin's hands and who is not going to do what Judith just said? We know that because he hasn't done it up to now. So therefore, what do we do between now and hopefully an election and then several weeks or months after that election? What do we do now?
I know what we do. We don't wait for Trump to do anything logical or responsible. But this is when Joe Biden can show up and show extraordinary leadership. Biden should be talking about, here is my approach. Here are the medical experts I have already convened. And Biden can pull in all the Democratic governors that he can find and some reasonable Republican governors like DeWine from Ohio. Biden can start implementing the plan. Maybe we don't get Texas and maybe we don't get Mississippi to be part of a national stay-at-home mandatory mask contact tracing policy. But you get as many states as possible. We are in an unprecedented time. I don't think anyone would object to Biden asserting himself. He obviously doesn't have the legal authorities that a president has, but he has Ron Klain and he has other experts who know how to get us out of here. He should just assume he's going to win and start acting presidential with governors.
All right, we're going to pause there. When we come back, we will continue. We have a lot of letters, and we'll also move on to other topics. Aaron, I know you have to run, but I thank you very much for being with us for
the first hour.
And you're with us next week, right? Is that true?
Oh, yeah. You're back? Can I make one quick point?
Sure.
Yes, I am.
We have to bum us out more? Go ahead.
No, this is the positive.
Okay, good.
What can we do between now and then? Mutual aid networks and neighborhood support, organizing those and helping at a very, 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 very local level, neighbors in need with community or organization assistance could be very helpful. I really just feel like this is like season one, episode two of Naked and Afraid, and this is just absolutely horrifying. So perhaps people can take action at the more local level and assist neighbors in need instead of waiting until January before Biden hopefully gets sworn in.
Aaron, thank you very much, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue with the rest of our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Ira Fussfeld, and Jennifer Burns, right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Ira Fussfeld, and Jennifer Burns. And it is a pleasure to have you all with us this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's move on to some other topics and talk about other things like what happened yesterday. Three presidents embrace the struggle for rights. Trump suggests postponing the election. That is the headline from the Washington Post this morning about what happened yesterday. Three presidents spoke in poetry, paying tribute to a fallen hero who believed, often against evidence to the contrary, including the cracking of his skull by state troopers, that America was good, its people driven by love to do right by one another. One president, the current commander-in-chief, did not attend the funeral of Representative John Lewis, but instead spoke of dark forces in the country and suggested that the United States not hold its next presidential election on time. In a country cleaved by political differences, paralyzed by a pernicious virus and suffering from a plunging economy, Thursday presented painful contrasts. It was a day of soaring tributes to the first black lawmaker to lie in state in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda, offered from the pulpit of the mother church of the modern civil rights movement. And it was a day of pointed reminders that the nation is struggling, even after 244 years, to define itself, to decide what freedom and equality will mean. Alan.
Well, you know, as we all watched it and everybody had tears in their eyes at one point or another, I was interested in the fact that this president, our last great president, Mr. Obama, did not mention the idea of postponing an election. So ludicrous. But I think Obama's need for dignity was so great I love the whole thing yesterday. I thought it was just the best of America. Love the fact that our congressman from the 1st District, Richie Neal, was there, because John Lewis really did care about his work on the Ways and Means Committee, of which our Richie Neal is the chair. And it was really quite a tribute to a man who knew how to buck the system, but at the same time work within it and do it effectively. I was very, very carried away with it.
Jennifer Burns.
You know, I think we saw a different Obama yesterday on race relations than we've seen in the past. He was very forthright. He was connecting history. He was calling out racism in far more direct ways than he did even during his presidency. And, you know, I thought one of the really the best lines that he made in his eulogy was about, you know, how it's a nice tribute to name, you know, the John Lewis voting rights law. But it's just a tribute, right? If you really want to do something to for politicians and for the American public, he laid out what needs to be changed for voting in this country to make liberty and freedom really, truly happen when it comes to the polls. And I thought that right there was really so central to honoring John Lewis's life, but also reminding people of the long history of voting suppression that John Lewis fought against and is happening again in America.
Yep. Yes.
Ira.
Well, it was hard not to be struck by the sight of the three former presidents, one of whom was not on the same side as was John Lewis for much of his term. The fourth other living president, not the current president, but the Jimmy Carter, I gather, couldn't be there for health reasons. And you watch something like what we saw yesterday, and it's sadly, it's for a funeral of a civil rights hero. But there's something comforting about the fact that there were these people of all points of view could come together, and the America could look like America again, at least for a few hours. And one can only hope that that there will be a cleansing in a couple of months. If Trump thought that raising the issue of postponing the election was going to be a distraction, and it did succeed to a certain extent being a distraction from the bad economic news and from the John Lewis funeral, he was slapped down rather quickly by members of his own party who went on record as saying there'll not be a delay in the election. So I just look at the funeral yesterday as being, in a way, John Lewis's final gift to this country, that he could his death has brought, at least for a few hours, people together, and this country is crying for it, in my opinion.
Judith.
Yeah, I think Ira said that beautifully. And if people haven't read John Lewis's op-ed in the New York Times yesterday, you definitely should. It was
gorgeous.
So moving.
Yeah.
And boy, what good press work to have your op-ed appear the day that you're being buried. He was very, very skilled at getting his message across. I mean, I think Jennifer's also right. Obama was so substantive and had much greater clarity than he's had before on many of these crucial issues. I don't want to overlook the importance of George W. Bush showing up. You know,
yeah.
John Lewis skipped Bush's inauguration as he skipped Trump's. But still, Bush showed up, I think, to try to help hold the country together. And I'm certainly no W. fan, but I thought his remarks were poignant, self-deprecating. In some ways, you know, Obama got the attention and the focus because he's such a legitimate president and so eloquent. But I think the presence of W. Bush was probably even more significant. And my final point is, when you look at the history of the last 3.5 years, which feel like 3.5 decades to many of us. I think yesterday is going to be a real historic marker. The funeral of John Lewis, while a sitting president of the United States sent out a tweet saying that the federal election should be delayed. I mean, the contrast, you know, the John Lewis who almost died for voting rights,
right,
and Trump's tweet. I mean, it's just astonishing.
The pushback was interesting because it came quickly. And so, Alan, what do you, I mean, a lot of us have thought for a long time that there would be pushback by Republicans on any number of issues that have come across our radar screens over the last 3.5 years, and there hasn't been a single blip. What was it about this, do you think, that finally got them saying no?
Well, you know, first of all, the Bushes really don't like Trump. That's for sure. And they have made that plain in a number of ways. So the fact that W, as Judith calls him, showed up makes it clear, puts a dot on that I or a cross on that T, that they have no use for him. I think also this is now embarrassing. The idea of calling off the peaceful transference of power. I think it's more than most Americans can absolutely bear, the idea that you would fool with an election or fool with the election process, which has never been done in this country. So I think that the fact that a Republican, you walk up to a Republican and say, should we call off the election? Now, there are a couple of fools out there. I'm going to call them that. They are fools who say, I haven't thought about that yet.
I didn't see the tweet. I don't read his tweet.
I haven't thought about that yet. It's really remarkable. And those people really do deserve two things. Number one, to take the elevator significantly downward, but also, in other words,
yes,
hell.
Yeah.
And
got it.
And they also need to be defeated at the polls.
The other thing I'd like to just spend a moment or two on, and Jennifer, let's start with you. I mean, it just the whole thing about the tweet that began our day yesterday was that mail-in voting, and they keep on bending over backwards to say not absentee voting, but mail-in voting is inaccurate and fraudulent. You know, every marker that we have, he the president yesterday during his press briefing held up a couple of articles that had been printed out online, which I don't think made the point ultimately that he was looking to make. However, we don't really have any evidence that it is inaccurate or fraudulent.
That is true. And actually, there are quite a few reports that say that what he's saying is absolutely false, that that's not really a problem, right? He's kind of just, it's a dog whistle tactic. It's all of his typical maneuvers to give misinformation that just gets people running all over the place rather than really focusing on what he really wants, which is to win by any means necessary, right? And to make it difficult for, as we know, predominantly Black and brown people, through gerrymandering and the alterations of that Voting Rights Act initially, to be able to cast a ballot, right? And you know, Obama brought this up too yesterday in his eulogy, saying it's a central strategy of voting suppression, that they make people so tired, or they make the process so difficult, or people feel so disillusioned with the government, they just say, never mind, right? And that people can't get the day off of work, or as we saw in Kentucky not too long ago, right? One polling place for the whole state. And so, you know, this is what Trump is doing. He's just throwing something out there that people will run with instead of focusing really on the issue, which is to continue to organize and press to get as many people to the polls as possible. Forget what he's saying. Forget it.
If you want to talk about fraudulent elections,
he's spinning around like a top, and it's clear that he is afraid. And not only of losing, but he's could lose in a historic an historic vote. And then in the afternoon, just hours after that tweet, when after getting the negative feedback that he got, he talks at a press conference saying, in effect, no, I don't want to change the date. It's just been his MO from day one. It's his MO. You know, if you go on YouTube, which I've had plenty of time to do these last 5 months, I found an interview from 1999 on 60 Minutes with Trump, and it could have been done yesterday. He basically, for better or worse, has had the same views that we're hearing today and throughout his presidency for decades. And to a certain extent, it has worked for him because, look, he's the president. But the performance yesterday following that tweet, he's just flailing around trying to find anything that's going to straighten his ship.
Alan?
You want to talk about fraudulent elections. Perhaps he's thinking about his friend Putin. You know, this country has a reputation for peaceful transfers of powers and correct elections. And Putin, of course, the Russians are suspected of doing all of the stuff that we know they do. Putin was a former KGB guy. We knew that. Everybody voted, by the way, and they all voted the right way. And here, somehow, even though there are protests in the streets, Putin gets most of the votes. So one has to wonder why he doesn't ever say why Trump doesn't ever say anything about that. Oh, I guess we don't have to wonder.
I want to go back to something Jennifer mentioned, and that was using the term of a dog whistle. You know, this goes back to a tweet that the president made, I believe, on Wednesday, where he said, "I am happy to inform all of the people living their suburban lifestyle dream." Each of those first words, first letter in each of those words capitalized, that you will no longer be bothered or financially hurt by having low-income housing built in your neighborhood. It seems to me, Jennifer, that that is not a dog whistle. That is just blatant out and out racism. And I don't know, in some ways it seems to be, even for him, sets a new standard.
I think it is for some people who are aware of the history of racial segregation patterns when it comes to home buying and suburban development. I don't think that's the case for people who don't know that long history of racial covenants, right? And so for them, the people who don't know that long history and were unaware of how President Obama had signed, you know, for the Affirmatively Further Housing or Fair Housing Act to continue to try to build the 1968 Civil Rights Act and fair housing, right? But more attached to the suburbs, which also then helps to build assets and wealth attainment for minorities who are able to purchase homes, right? By dismantling that, what he did for people who don't know that long history is basically say they won't move in. And what he means by the poor, of course, is black and brown people. And so for people who don't know that long history, they don't see the pattern that this kind of tactic was used before, and he's doing it again.
Well, that was the cornerstone of his real estate business with his father, Fred Trump, was making sure black and brown people did not move into their apartments.
The second part of that tweet, too, is your housing prices will go up based on the market and crime will go down. I have rescinded the Obama-Biden AFFH rule. Enjoy! Exclamation point.
You know what gets your favorite president?
Yeah.
You know, it gets a little bit more dangerous than this. And Jennifer, I wonder if you would react to this. It's not only the rules. It's the reason we live in a racist country. Let's face it. We know that. And people moved out of cities for reasons. They moved out because, you know, they were perpetuating the racist standards of the country. So it's not only that there were rules that had to be changed. It was minds had to be changed also. And I suspect what I'm seeing now in the suburbs is that some of those minds are being changed to the better. I think that's what this is all about.
You know, I think some, I don't think that's the case from Trump at all.
No. I'm talking about people who moved out of cities. People moved out of cities because of the racist ideology in this country. Let's face it. That's why they moved. And it's taken a lot to get people to say, this isn't fair. Black Lives Matter. This is not right. But I think I'm sensing some change now. Because the real problem is not with Trump. The problem is that when Trump does that dog whistle, he knows who's listening.
Correct. And, you know, that whole movement, there's been a couple of movements of white flight. It wasn't just the initial movement from urban areas to early suburban areas in the 40s and 50s. That continued to happen even in the 70s as we see the increase, or we saw the increase of a growth due to the civil rights movement changes of African Americans into the middle class and into suburban developments. Initially, many of those suburban developments, though, that African Americans did move into were still racially segregated suburban developments, though. They were not fully integrated. And we today are at the point where, depending on where you are in the country, suburban developments are still less than half fully integrated, right? That means you still have huge swaths of suburban developments that are racially segregated.
Exactly.
So, you know, that's the key here is it sounds good on the face value, and we hear that, but we don't really look at how that segregation pattern is still taking place, right? So this is another way of, I would say, bolstering, it could bolster another white flight into gated style communities, right? But I do agree that there are many people who are white, who are in suburbs, who are awakening to the Black Lives Matter. And we see that with white children or white youth involved in this movement. So it could have a different effect. However, at the same time we say that, that means we could be waiting a generation to see.
Let's go to some letters. Roger says, how ironic that on a day when President Obama made one of his most inspiring speeches in honor of a great American icon, President Trump was doing his best to discredit the election before it occurs in direct opposition to Lewis's legacy. Is there anyone of integrity of the administration, get ready, Alan, certainly lacking among the Republican leadership, especially in the Senate, to invoke the 25th Amendment and get rid of the most incompetent and dangerous president in our history before he destroys our constitutional republic?
Let everybody go read the 25th Amendment. It's almost impossible because you've got to depend on a majority of the principal officers of government, meaning the cabinet, and who put them there and how they're acting. And the Republican Senate has a role. It is not as easy as I get the frustration in the letter. And I get a lot of letters about the 25th Amendment. It's just that, be realistic, there's one way to make this change, and that's to vote, and vote in large numbers.
And I want to add a point on that. I want to circle back for a minute to Trump clearly is trying to delegitimize the November election.
Yep.
Putting Trump aside, we have a very shaky voting system in this country. Boards of elections are in the 18th century. They cannot handle large numbers of people voting by mail. Just look at the New York primary. There's still a race that isn't decided.
We don't know Maloney. Right,
yeah,
Maloney, the east side.
6 weeks after people voted. What we need to really pay attention to now is making sure that state boards of election come into this century. I think there's going to be a very high voter turnout, both in person and by mail. And I think the election system is going to collapse. That has nothing, some of this has to do with Trump in terms of him trying to slow down the postal system. But put Trump aside, the New York voting system is not a model of efficiency.
Thinking hanging chads in Florida. Look at how long that took. And we probably got a bad result because we didn't do it right.
That's what I'm most worried about, is just the collapse of voting. And Trump will be there to exploit that. This is something governors and secretaries of states and county governments can be focusing on right now.
The right way, you hope, Judith, not the wrong way. In other
yes.
words, the secretaries of states are political officers, too.
Right.
And they are appointed or selected according to the prevailing winds in a particular state. And if they happen to be Republican and they happen to be told something, God only knows where they'll be.
Which we saw in Georgia in the Stacey Abrams race
mm-hmm.
with the now governor. Deborah,
among other things, you need more polling places. I believe Obama alluded to that yesterday. You know, if you had three polling places for every one that there are now, the likelihood of people standing out in the rain or the cold for hours to vote would be obviated. And that's the sort of thing that governments, state governments, should be working on, you know, the day after the last election. They should be analyzing the issues that arose during an election and making do.
But, Ira, really, it's even worse than that.
Just 30 seconds. Go ahead.
They're not getting more. They're closing them up for good reason.
They're closing them up. Absolutely. It's horrible.
All right, we're up against a break, so I'm just going to pause the conversation for a moment, and when we come back, we'll go to letters, we'll go to other topics, and we will discuss more in our last round together. A great panel this morning: Alan Shartok, Judith Enck, Ira Fussfeld, and Jennifer Burns. We welcome your letters. We still have time for some. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Keep them short, keep them to the point. And we will continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. I just want to send out a shout out, if I can, to one of our very own. Our Berkshire Bureau Chief Josh Landes was off yesterday. And the reason he was...
What happened?
I know. Well, the reason he was off is because he got engaged. He got engaged to Allie, who is his now fiance, and we would just like to wish Josh and Allie the best of luck and congratulate them very heartily on the engagement. Very
Yay.
Nice.
A royal wedding, a WAMC royal wedding.
And as Alan would often say, what, and 2 weeks later they were married, right?
Right.
So congratulations, Josh and Allie. We are very happy for you. That is quite wonderful news. We'll take wonderful news wherever we can get it.
Not only that.
Okay, Joe, can I point out something?
Go ahead.
When I was working at a small newspaper, we were always looking for the local angle. And I don't know how many people saw it, and I don't know if NBC is the only network that ran it. But they ran several times throughout the day yesterday a still photo of Obama embracing John Lewis on the occasion of the first inauguration and sitting right behind John Lewis beaming with that big shock of white hair was our friend, the late Congressman Hinchy.
Maura Hinchy, yeah.
And it was fun to see him back in the limelight.
He was, yeah, indeed. Yeah. Alan, you were going to say, too.
Yes, if you think I remember it. Oh, yes, I remember now. We were talking about Josh today. Ed Markey is coming. He's going to be at the gazebo at 12:30 in Great Barrington, and then he's going up to Pittsfield, and Josh is back on the job.
Yes. You don't get that much time out just for being engaged.
2 days when you get married.
All right.
It's in the handbook.
It is. I think it is. It's in our handbook. All right. Let's move on. We've been dancing around it all morning. But we haven't directly talked about the coronavirus. As states scramble to put out fires, Fauci and other top U.S. health officials are back in Congress. I mentioned this earlier, 2 days after U.S. deaths surpassed 150,000. I believe we are now over 152,000. Three familiar federal health officials, including Dr. Fauci, returning to Capitol Hill and are there now testifying in front of a new audience, the House's Special Select Committee investigating the Trump administration's response to the pandemic. Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Disease Control and Prevention is there as well. And Admiral Brett Girard, I believe is how that is pronounced. I've heard it many times, and I think I always screw it up. But the Assistant Secretary for Health in the administration's point person on coronavirus testing. So that is going on. With the headline so far being that Dr. Fauci saying that he is cautiously optimistic that a vaccine could be ready by the end of the year. Meanwhile, the crisis is mounting in the United States, and the numbers are huge. Arizona reported 158 new deaths on Thursday, a single-day record. Florida set death records 3 days in a row this week, hitting its latest record, 253 on Thursday. California saw back-to-back records with 172 deaths reported on Tuesday and 192 on Wednesday. So again, very grim news when it comes to the coronavirus. And as we have been talking all along, any relief package that was expected as a result has been put on hold as the Senate has left, and we are now waiting to see what will come about next week. And meanwhile, other places that were once getting better, like New Jersey, now is seeing an uptick in cases, and a lot of this has to do with the Jersey Shore. People going to, you know, just a few weeks ago, New Jersey had its lowest 7-day total, and now those numbers are much higher, and the cases, I believe it was, they're averaging about 416 cases a day, and a lot of it because of the easing of restrictions, and elected leaders are worried and public health officials are concerned and, you know, are looking about at the precautions they can take to, again, shut down the beaches and try to keep people home. So with all of that,
there are two reasons not to go to the beach. The first of them is the coronavirus.
Yep.
The second?
Shark.
Yes.
Yeah.
Or as my colleague at Channel 6 used to say, shark attack.
Shark attack. 45th anniversary of Jaws, and we're still scared, and rightfully so. Judith.
So one person is dying every minute in this country due to coronavirus.
Right.
And it's just getting worse. There was a press report yesterday that a reporter got their hands, so meaning it was leaked to a reporter, that the CDC has identified 98 emerging corona hotspots in the country in 30 different states. But the CDC won't make that information public. Mm. They are derelict in their duty because they're afraid of the White House. So, you know, I've kind of had personally kind of a change of heart. I've been anxiously watching all of the coverage of is a vaccine coming? How are they going to actually distribute the vaccine? You know, discovering the vaccine is half of it. The rest is how do you get it out, with many medical experts saying it's going to take years to vaccinate the whole country. So this is why I feel so strongly that Biden needs to act like he's president. He needs to get experts together. He has to put a plan in place based on quarantine and then testing and then contact tracing. I'm very fearful about September, not only when little kids go back to school, but college students coming in from all over the world. You know, we have a million international students at the college level in this country. Many stayed here, but some will be traveling here. I don't know why they're coming back here if they're in safer countries. But September is going to be brutal, and we can't just passively wait for a new president to be sworn in January and pray for a breakthrough on the vaccine.
I think I have some differences with you, Judith. We have one president at a time. There's no question about that. Biden, to me, there is only one important thing that's going on right now, and that is what's going to happen in November. Are we going to get rid of this guy? Now, if that's the case, and he's out, we have an operational philosophy now on the part of Biden, which is to keep shut. Which is to keep, you know, you make a moderate pronouncement every once in a while, and then you get out of his way. You get out of Trump's way as he destroys himself. Now, all he has to do, all Biden has to say is, well, I'm almost president of the United States, so I'm going to implement a policy right now and have an effective other presidency than that of Trump. I think it may be a tactic. I don't know that a lot of you are going to like this, but I think it may be a tactical mistake considering that the number one issue is Trump losing?
Well, I think it's not binary. I mean, there's obviously you only have one president at a time, and Biden doesn't have the executive authorities that the sitting president has. But I think this country is thirsty for leadership and information. And I don't think there's anything wrong with Biden saying, I have convened my expert panel, and they're the doctors, and they say we should do this, this, and this. This is what I would do if I was president. And I encourage states that are circling the drain to start doing this now.
So I'll meet you halfway.
Yeah.
I'll meet you halfway. This is what I will do when I'm president, based on the information I'm getting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fine. I mean, I just think we don't have the luxury of waiting until January. Things are, you know, one death a minute. It's going to be one death every 30 seconds.
But we don't want to screw it up. That's all I'm saying. I think we're in the same place.
Yeah. Totally agree.
God knows we don't want to screw it up. Let's see. I want to go back to letters, if I can. I just have to find them, and we'll go to Elizabeth, who says, if Jeff Bezos invented and now successfully runs Amazon, Elizabeth admits being a devout Amazon user, he deserves to be financially rewarded. How, though, is it possible to be rewarded to the tune of $120 billion? Isn't there something wrong here? Are these billions made on the backs of famously ill-paid workers? What kind of system is this where the idea of paying employees well and providing health insurance, which I understand Amazon does not, is rejected because it would, what, bankrupt the economy? How much profit is too much? To paraphrase someone, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. Thanks for the roundtable, a comfort in frightening times.
Interesting letter. Interesting letter. The real problem is, why did Bezos get so rich? Right? He got rich because he has a product that an awful lot of people, denials aside, want to use. They want to order a book and get it for cheaper than they buy it in our wonderful bookstore here in Great Barrington, which I love. But people are doing that. I like to support our local businesses. But a lot of people say it's the truck will roll up to my front door and here will be the thing. And good on them, because that he's made my life better. That's what they're thinking.
Well, it's not just that. It's also that some people who are ordering books can't afford to go into a local independent bookstore and pay the full price. So they need that discount. So in many ways, he's preying on financially struggling people who order books, college students included.
Mm. Well, why are you saying preying on? See, Jennifer, I don't get that part of it. In fact,
because
somebody
he knows.
Could...
He knows.
And let's not forget, I just want to broaden the conversation a little bit, but let's not forget that Amazon sells everything from, yes, books, mm-hmm. but...
groceries.
You know, groceries, if you need dog biscuits, if you need, you know, a 12-pack of marinade or a refrigerator, there it is. Go ahead.
But Jennifer, I thought you were going in a different direction, which is there are a lot of poor people in this country, and you've been very articulate about pointing that out. Now, along comes Amazon and says, okay, instead of paying $25 for a book, or you'll pay $10, or instead of buying this for grocery, you'll pay less. But you're saying he's preying on them, and that's a tough one for me.
Well, preying in the sense of what the worker is getting paid, right, Jennifer?
Right. He's taking he's capitalizing himself on knowing that he pays his workers less, many other companies do. You know, the living wage for people in America is struggling. And now you look at the pandemic and you see the disparities and how many people, especially if the relief bill is cut down to $200 or no dollars, you know, for some people in America, right? So they can then get as many things as possible, because Amazon has gone beyond books as well, for cheaper prices. And that makes it more affordable for them. Right?
Well, intellectually,
he knows that.
You are certainly correct. Intellectually. But emotionally, you should see that truck stopping on our street and, going house to house delivering stuff.
I'm not saying it's good. We see people across the country,
yeah.
Right, who are even voting against things that are good for them, right? Many people going out for Trump or other, you know, state or local officials who are really looking to dismantle the Affordable Health Care Act and change that up that's going to cause poor people to struggle more, but they're still going to vote against that. So the emotional toll continues to be there.
And who's the number one? And who's the number one Trump enemy in the world right now? Jeff Bezos. So it gets complicated.
Right.
Well, it's not just about Amazon though. I think it's about monopolies. It's Apple. It's banks. It's telecom. Zephyr Teachout, a familiar name to many of us, has a new book come. Yep, I think she's terrific, and she has a new book coming out on monopolies that I think we should all take a look at, because it's a big part of our personal commerce, like it or not.
We have. We just have one or two more letters I'll get to, and then we have to call it a morning, unfortunately.
No.
I'm sorry. Sebastian says, maybe I missed it, but why are we avoiding the conversation about the military spending in the bill? I don't think we were avoiding. We did talk about it yesterday. Anybody want to weigh in?
Yeah, it's crazy. There's all sorts of bad things being snuck into the stimulus bill that hasn't passed, and I might add, may not pass.
Right.
I mean, as the professor provided the great information this morning, the unemployment bump up expires today. And so if Congress doesn't feel political pressure to deal with that issue, I don't know when they're going to come back to deal with everything else.
Oh, yes, they do. They feel, you mean about the military. I get it. But yes, they certainly feel the pressure. And I certainly believe that if Trump is saying, let's just continue with what we got, he's throwing in the towel. And those Republicans who have to win their Senate seats are going to insist that some deal be made. And I still say between $3 billion and $1 billion, it's going to end up at $2 billion. And that'll be that. They'll have to do it. They'll get there.
We are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Alan Chartok, thank you very much, of course. Judith Enk and Jennifer Burns and Aaron Pasitti, thank you all. Ira, great to have you back. Have a beautiful weekend, everyone.
Yay.
We'll return right after
this.
Thanks,
Joe.